On revenue for May 4th, 2007 will come to order. We're starting a few minutes late because the House session ran long, and we're going to start from the top of our agenda and see how far we can get. Therefore, we're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 175. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 175 comes from the Department of Revenue, and it reduces the time period that DOR must wait for demanding a taxpayer file a tax report or return, and imposing a failure to file penalty in cases where the report or return is required to be filed more often than once a year. Most of these returns or reports that are required to be filed quarterly, and under current law, the Department of Revenue must wait 3 months before demanding that the taxpayer file the report. The time period is reduced from 3 months to 1 month after the filing or payment due date. In cases where the taxpayer is required to file a federal income tax or return for a period of less than 12 months, the current waiting period of 3 months is retained, so it doesn't affect those. And the changes would apply to reports or returns filed on or after January 1, 2008. And it has you should have a revenue impact statement with you also that came over from the Senate side. It has a minimal revenue impact. It's not expected to really affect the collection efforts in any great way. In any significant way with respect to dollars.
Thank you. And the only person signed up is the department. Deborah?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Debbie Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, staff has done an excellent job, as usual, in explaining our bill. And I have handed out just a one-page summary of what we're attempting to do, which is to shorten the timeline for reports that are required to be filed more often than once a year. We have several tax programs that we administer, including the cigarette tax program, the state lodging tax program, where quarterly reports are required to be filed. The difficulty is that if a person does not file those reports on time, under current law, we need to wait 3 months to demand a return from them, and then wait an additional 2 months to demand payment. By that time, we're well into the second or third reporting period. What we would like to do is be able to get to those people earlier in the process to help them if they have problems and make sure that the returns are being filed and payments are being made. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you. Deborah, how much... How often are these reports delinquent in this sense? Is it 10%, 50%?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, it would not be 50%. I think it's a small percentage of the population that's not getting in on time. And, of course, that would go up during tough economic times. I think people tend to not do their reporting and paying when they have a hard time doing that. But... I don't actually have a percentage, but I'm sure it's not 50%.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to scale here.
Thank you. Why do you want this?
Mr. Chairman, we would like this because what we find now is that, let's assume we have an employer that's been filing with us on time each quarter for a number of years, and then all of a sudden we don't get a report. But they haven't informed us that they're no longer in business. Then we need to send them a request to file. They may ignore that letter. It will be 3 months before we can send a demand to file. So by that time, they're already into the next reporting period and possibly late on that reporting period. What we would like to do is shorten that time period and say, if they haven't filed that report for a month, we can issue the demand, and then within 30 days of that time, request the payment. So it brings our contact time much shorter. We can get them back in the system if they need to be filing, work with them if they have problems in making the payments on a much shorter time frame than current law allows.
Right, and I understood all of that. What I don't understand is why you want the shorter time, why you want the shorter amount of time. There may be a perfectly wonderful reason, I just don't know what it is.
Mr. Chairman, it's so that we can get them back into the system sooner if they need to be in the system, and so that we can collect the money sooner if they owe us the money.
All right. And do we have losses that result from the elapse of the time where people never pay us?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the statistics that show that. I could assume that that would be true, but I don't have the facts here to answer that yes or no.
All right. Thank you. Are there other questions for Deborah? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on Senate Bill 175? I'm not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing on 175. Colleagues, if you've had a chance to look at the bill, are we ready to work this bill? I'm getting head nods. Okay. All right. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 175. What's your pleasure? Representative Gelser.
I would move Senate Bill 175 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelser moves Senate Bill 175 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I think this is going to be easy, Ms. Buchanan. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Yes. Aye.
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 Yes. The motion having received the required majority, the bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any reason why this should not go on the consent calendar? It's a very simple idea. Go ahead. There were seven no's in the Senate.
I would be happy to carry the bill.
Representative Gelser will carry. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 175. The next bill on our agenda is Senate Bill 176, and I think that's also yours, Chris.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
I'm sorry. We'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 176. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 176 also comes from the Department of Revenue, and it allows the transfer of outstanding liability for taxes, penalty, or interest from a business entity that dissolves and then reorganizes as a substantially the same business. The bill specifies factors that may be considered when determining if the dissolved and reorganized businesses are essentially the same. Factors that can be included are the physical location of the businesses, the services provided or products produced by the businesses, if the businesses have the same corporate directors or officers, or if the businesses have the same owners or holders of a direct or indirect interest in the business. There are certain cases under current law where the Department of Revenue is allowed to transfer these liabilities. It extends that authority in these cases. And in the revenue impact that you should have in front of you, it does have a revenue impact of about $300,000 in 2007-09 and about $200,000 in 2009-11. And the bump there is that there are some outstanding cases known by the Department of Revenue that if this were to pass, they could collect on those, or at least proceed with the collection activities. And then the recurring $100,000 is an estimate of the long-term behavioral impact on collections.
Thank you. Again, the department, Ms. Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, we're looking at, in some cases, similar businesses to what was described with Senate Bill 175. And this authority in Senate Bill 176 would allow us to look at a business that has incurred a tax debt but has not paid the debt. And the business then dissolves, discontinues, but reestablishes itself under a new name, having essentially the same operators, running essentially the same business with the same assets, perhaps in the same location. And we would look at that and say the only reason that you did that was to avoid paying the tax debt. The debt would transfer from the original business to the successor business. As was mentioned, we do have authority to transfer liabilities now in some cases. For example, if an employer does not pay its withholding tax to the state, then we can look at officers of the business that were liable for making those payments and transfer that debt to those officers. So this is similar in some respects to that particular provision in law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Deborah, I'm just curious, what happens if there's a complete clean separation and let's say 6 months later, someone came in from another state and bought the same business and revitalized it. And
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, if we have a legitimate transfer, a legitimate business sale, we're not going to go after that. What we're looking at is the person who has a debt, closes down shop, opens up the next day in the same place with just a different business name, reincorporated with a new corporate identity. We can't transfer the debt. This would allow us to look at that and say, you're running the same business, it's the same person, you have that debt that you had yesterday.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Brown.
Just to make a point, not to pick on any particular industry, especially one that I work in when I'm not here, but this is especially rampant in the construction subcontracting industry. Not necessarily laying fault or anything, but you have many, many one, two, three-person operations that will get themselves into trouble, and they'll just close down that business, get a new business license, file a new CCB number, and they're off and running, and all their past debts are somewhere else.
Okay. Yes. Others? The key to this kind of a bill are the details.
Yes, sir.
Would you go through the bill with us and help us to understand when, and I take it that the key issue here is reorganized business entity and the power of the department to apply old taxes to a reorganized business entity. And then Section 2 describes as exceptions to that, I guess sub B, when it doesn't apply. And then the sub 2 of Section 2 talks about when you can transfer. Could you walk us through that so that we can understand exactly where this power is and where it is not?
Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to try to do that.
Thank you.
Again, as you noted, the reorganized business entity, so we're looking at one that is operating substantially the same business. So, for example, if you're talking about a person who sells cigarette and other tobacco products, and that is the same as another entity that now has a tax debt. And again, this is just for programs administered by the Department of Revenue, so we're not looking at debt that comes to us from other agencies. It's only the programs that we have. So there's been that transfer of assets to a new entity that's substantially the same as what was there before. It would not include, and again on page 1, line 11, a business entity converted to a different form, or if you have a change in ownership solely because of a transfer of assets, or if you have an investor with no right to manage the business entity, we wouldn't be going after them. And then there is a list of those on lines 15 through 17. So you have a minority shareholder. We would not be going after a minority shareholder. A member of a manager-managed limited liability company, so there's a difference in limited liability companies between member-managed and manager-managed. So you're looking at someone who has a passive investment. We wouldn't go after that person. Or you have a limited partner in a limited partnership, so no control over the business. Those are the exceptions that would not be considered liable. And then again, we can transfer the liability for the taxes, the interest, or penalties administered and collected by the department. That's, in, as you noted, on line 19 of page 1. What we would look at in determining whether it's a successor business, are they operating in the same physical location as the person that owed the debt? Are they providing the same service or manufacturing the same product? Are they the same corporate directors or officers as the taxpayer that owed the debt? Or are the owners or holders of a direct or indirect business interest in the entity the same as the taxpayer owing the debt? So those are the factors, Mr. Chair, that we would consider. It can be subjective in nature, so we would want to have some very clear parameters in administering the bill. And we would expect to do those as by rule also.
And then the next section is about notice.
Once we have determined that there should be a transfer, we're sending a notice to the new entity stating that the debt has been transferred. And then within 30 days, they can either pay or file a written objection with us of the that they don't believe that transfer should be done. And then, as exists under current law, they could ask for a conference with us. We will hold a conference and then let them know either that we are standing by that transfer or we would cancel it. They can then either pay the assessment or appeal to the tax court.
And if they don't do any of that, then the liability becomes final.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Does that generate other additional questions from the members of the committee? Yeah, Representative Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, Deborah, is there a scenario where they would be able to make such a transfer and then somehow owe less tax as a result than they did before?
Mr. Chairman,
by being able to take advantage of some credits or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, I can't think of a situation where that might occur because what we're looking at is a fixed tax debt. And the debt itself has been established and reduced by any credits that are available to the taxpayer. So the transfer of the debt itself to someone else doesn't allow that debt then to be recalculated and offset by credits.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Deborah, on the front of the bill, line 11, does not include, on your exceptions, does not include a business entity that has converted to a different form. I'm not sure what that means, different form.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, what we had in mind there is the sole proprietor that decides to incorporate and form a C corporation. It was the feeling that because you do have a clearly different entity in that case, the debt should remain with the individual as a sole proprietor and not be transferred to the corporation. So in that example, the debt would remain with the individual and we would still be going after the individual for collection of the debt. The assets that have been transferred to the C corporation now are assets of the corporation, which stands as a different entity. Where we would be transferring is if an individual has formed a C corporation and has assets, there are assets in the C corporation, and now that C corporation dissolves, but another C corporation is established and the assets are transferred. Even though they are different corporations, the transfer of debt would occur. So we're looking at, do you have really two different types completely of entities?
Yes, please.
Deborah, what happens if you have somebody, and I know you can go crazy with hypotheticals, but you could have someone organized as a sole proprietorship and get this problem and then suddenly say, okay, I'm going to dissolve my proprietorship and reorganize as an S. Would, under this exemption then, the debt would stay with the sole proprietorship and the S-Corp would be a new corporation. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes, that is correct.
I just want to put that in the record. Thank you.
Representative Webb?
Nothing, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
I thought you had something. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much. Gordon Hillsland?
Yes, sir. Good morning. What piqued my interest with this bill was it was so restricted.
Mr. Hillsland, would you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Gordon Hillsland.
Thank you.
Thank you. What piqued my interest with this bill was it was so restrictive. I used to be a tax collector with Internal Revenue Service. And talking to Deborah, I find out it's restrictive for a purpose. They want to get the bulk of the fraudulent population, and they want to get something passed, so they are being very restrictive. So I certainly don't disagree with this legislation. However, I would like to say that they need much broader legislation. And in my package, I've included an article from Willamette Week from 2003 that illustrates that DEQ assessed a fine against a man who transferred his assets and the Department of Revenue was unable to collect. I don't know if it was passed through warrants or not. It sounds like it was not. But they really need to, as Internal Revenue Code 6901 does, they need to address a broad-based ability to pursue fraudulent transactions on a non-criminal basis, and they need an administrative statute that will allow them to do that. So if you get something that says something like if a transfer of an asset is fraudulently transferred to avoid payment of a debt, then they can pursue. They'll have to jump through some hoops, and we had to get a judge to confer, but it was handled in a non-criminal manner. And in many cases, time is of the essence, even if it's real estate, because if you start Department of Justice investigation with a court case. It could be a long time, and they'll transfer the property many times. In that period of time, you need to be able to do it in 30, 60 days. And I would hope that eventually you would give them a broad-based administrative statute that would let them pursue.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Hillisland? Thank you very much for your testimony. Oh, that's another perspective for us. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on Senate Bill 176? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 176. Are we ready to work this bill today? We are. All right. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 176. What's your pleasure, committee?
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Bill 176 be sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Reed moves Senate Bill 176 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Berger.
Aye.
Representative
Brown.
Aye.
Representative
Butler.
Aye.
Representative
Olson.
Yes.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Aye. The bill, having received the required majority, is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who would like to, should we put this one on the consent calendar? Actually, we shouldn't. We had a bunch of no's, I guess, in the Senate on this bill as well. Who would like to carry?
I don't care. I'll do it.
Representative Olson.
Yep.
The policeman can carry the fraud bill. Good.
Hey.
Thank you. Representative Olson will carry. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 176. Senate Bill 173, that's today yours as well. All right, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 173.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 173 also comes from the Department of Revenue, and it would allow the department to disclose confidential information from tax returns to cities, counties, or other political subdivisions of states, or an association established exclusively to provide services to federal, state, or local taxing authorities. So just within the respective tax administration and compliance. The entity must be governed by a provision of law that meets the requirements of the Internal Revenue Code pertaining to confidentiality. And you do have a revenue impact, but it is expected to be minimal. It would just allow the department to share information.
Is there a fiscal on this one?
I don't know.
Don't think so. Okay. Again, from the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 173 does, as staff indicated, it authorizes us to share information with entities in addition to what current law allows. Currently, the law allows us to disclose confidential tax information to the Internal Revenue Service, to the Multi-State Tax Commission, or to other states, as long as those states have a provision of law that meets IRS confidentiality requirements. The difficulty that we have now is that tax administration organizations have set up databases. One of those particular databases allows the City of New York to participate. The cities are not included in the law as entities to which we can disclose information. So we can receive information from the database, but we can't be a full participant in that. And on page 2 of the handout that I've provided to you, you'll notice the states that do participate in the uniform agreement that was established by the Federation of Tax Administrators. You'll notice that Nevada, New Mexico, and Oregon are the only three that are not signatories to that agreement. So we currently do receive information from this database. We just can't share fully the information with the other states and cities. I've also attached a copy of the Uniform Exchange of Information Agreement that we would be a signatory to if we entered into this. And again, what the databases do is allow states to share information about taxpayers only for tax administration purposes. For example, another state may do an audit on a multi-state corporation and then submit that information to the database. Oregon can receive that, but if Oregon does an audit on a similar corporation, we can't submit that information to the database for use by other states because a city is a participant in that. So this would allow us to participate fully in those exchange agreements. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions? Would you be Representative Berger?
Deborah, page 2, and actually it's referenced in Chris Kalanick's. What is an association established exclusively to provide services to federal, state, and local taxing authorities? Could you give me an example of what that is?
An example of that is the Federation of Tax Administrators, which is an organization made up of the tax administration agencies of each state. But again, it also includes the City of New York in participating in the database. So that is an example of that type of association.
Mr. Chair, can I...
Yes, please, follow up.
For what purpose would you be sharing information with them?
Only for tax administration and compliance purposes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, and you find that on lines 23 and 24.
I guess I'm having trouble understanding what an association would need. I mean, I thought you were going to say something like tax soup in Multnomah County or something like that. I didn't expect you to say it. That sounds more like I don't know what that association you mentioned are, but they aren't. It sounds like I'm not sure why they would need this information. Pursue this. I'm lost.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, I'm sorry. I probably wasn't clear in explaining this. The Federation of Tax Administrators is made up of the agencies of each state, and what they have done is established a database that allows each state to submit information about taxpayers in that state. So it could be audit information. It could be refund claims. It might be abusive tax shelters that they have seen particular taxpayers participating in, and that information is compiled by the association and made available to each state. It's not that the association itself acts on the information that's submitted. They act as a clearinghouse for the information.
Okay, can I pursue that?
Please.
Is this sort of like a crime database that they maintain? I mean, is this like a sex offender registry, a tax cheat registry? I'm not visualizing this very well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, I wouldn't use any of those terms, but I think it's...
But Beth, you're not nicer than I am, Deborah.
It's, Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, it's an information clearinghouse is how I would describe it. It accepts tax information to be accessible to the various states for tax compliance and administration purposes only. So that rather than our department having to go, for example, to the revenue department in the state of Colorado and try to get information about multi-state corporations that are operating in Colorado, Colorado can provide that information to the database, and then Oregon can access the database and look at the information provided not only by Colorado for a taxpayer, but the information provided by New York for the same taxpayer.
Yes,
please,
just a moment.
Continue.
I get that. That makes a certain amount of sense. Is there any other association... I don't really like language like this association established to provide services. Is there any other? Is that the only one that would come under this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, when we were having this legislation drafted, that's the only one that we had in mind, and that's the only one that I'm familiar with. But this is the language that Legislative Council recommended, and we believe that the words that say exclusively to provide services to local taxing authorities are limiting the associations that we would be providing information to.
Thank you for that explanation. That helps me. I'm not sure that it makes me feel good. Mr. Chair, if I could comment.
Yes, please.
I'm having a little heartburn here about sharing information and where we're sharing it. I really appreciate the answers that Deborah has given, however. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bruin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. One is sort of taking off from where Representative Berger was going with this. What protections do Oregon taxpayers have for inappropriate use by another state, whether it's by accident or through, you know, security breach or whatever the situation du jour may be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin, the states that are participating in the agreement are bound to keep the information confidential, just as the department is. We, in our law, have a provision that imposes a $10,000 fine and it's considered a Class C felony for us to disclose confidential information inappropriately. So again, the other states need to keep this information confidential, and they cannot disclose the information without the submitting state's permission to any other state. So there are significant restrictions, and I would also say the department is very cautious about what it does with taxpayer information. We try to be very, very aware of the restrictions that you have put on that information, that you do want it to remain confidential, and we take that very seriously.
And I maybe mention this, I didn't hear this. How long has this system been in place? Because I'm looking at your page 2 of your handout, and I, by my quick count, I see that approximately 29 or 30, and you know, we're three that haven't signed on yet, but approximately 29 or 30 have signed on in the last year or a year and a half. So is there something driving this quick time frame, or is it just because it's brand new and that's how long it's taken to roll out the door?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin, actually, on page 10 of the handout, you'll notice that it took effect January 1 of 1993. And between the time that I presented this information to the Senate committee and this presentation, there were four or five states that had reviewed their participation and updated the date. So that is why the dates appear to be so recent, is that they have actually...
And I noticed that Nebraska has somehow changed the time continuum because they're way ahead of the pack there. So,
no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
They do things differently in Nebraska.
They do things differently there. They certainly do. Just to follow up on Representative Bruin's question, to make certain that I understand this, all of the states that are signers and the city of New York and the association that administers this program are all bound by strict confidentiality rules. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So, in effect, what we are doing if we become signatories of this agreement is we're allowing tax information to flow into the association and hence to the states or the city of New York who might need it on a particular taxpayer, but no further.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Into those tax authorities that are required to comply with the confidentiality requirements. And I note that on page 7 of your material, there's a long section, Article 5 of the Agreement on Confidentiality. I'm assuming that complies with Oregon law, or at least it's congruent with Oregon law.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
And is no less restrictive than Oregon law on confidentiality. It might be more restrictive, but no less restrictive. We're not agreeing to reduce the restrictions that are required under Oregon law for tax information.
No, sir.
Okay. Does that? Yes, Representative Byrne.
I was going to do one more follow-up. Thank you for your accommodation, Mr. Chair. Deborah, have you had any conversations with any of your contemporaries in other states that are in the same position you, as whether or not that are already signatories to this, to whether or not they've gleaned a value from it? And we could talk about a theoretical value. Have they seen specific values from being part of this network?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, you, if I could answer this way, you have a bill coming to this committee on Monday, Senate Bill 39, that is an attempt to address some abusive tax avoidance transaction activity. And it's our view that in order for us to use that legislation well, should you decide to pass it, Senate Bill 173 is something we definitely need. because we need to be able to share information about those abusive transactions. And if team audit reports and client audit reports about the transactions that we have seen.
Mr. Chair, I just raised the question, and I'm sure this is good legislation in a lot of regards. It's difficult for me in this age we live in to get my arms all the way around it with sharing with states throughout the nation that we don't really have any control over. If I don't know it's a clear problem, if I know it's a clear problem, then there's other states could show here's what we've been able to do with this. But and that might be out there. I mean, it's not to say that it's not, but that's my early reservation about this, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, and I appreciate that. And Representative Olson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Deborah, the law enforcement data system tied in with the National Crime Information Center that's available for law enforcement and the criminal justice community, I sense that this is almost kind of a similar type concept. But within our state here, as well as with NCIC in LEDS, we have what's known as an audit that occurs. Has there been any consideration of that at all on an annual basis of the program for each state or within our state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, if I understand, are you asking whether there is an audit of the clearinghouse itself?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I don't have that information, but I will get that for you.
Thank you, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, the penalties that accrue to the department now for releasing information improperly, if this information were given to another state and then somehow got released, would those penalties still apply?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, I don't know whether the penalties would be imposed on the state that inappropriately releases the information, but I will find that out.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on Senate Bill 173? Colleagues, I think the questions are substantive and they're important. And what I'd like to do is hold the work session on this bill over till Monday, until after the hearing on Senate Bill 39, so we'll have a better answer to some of the questions. And perhaps, do you think you could have the answers to the questions that have been raised on Monday?
I will.
Thank you. And so with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 173, and we'll hold the work session over until Monday, so we'll have that for our agenda. On Monday. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 171. You recall, colleagues, that this was carried over from yesterday.
Chair, Senate Bill 171 enables the department to share with the tax assessor, county tax collector, or their representatives any information that has been reported on tax returns to the department by entities described by statute, which include electric companies, communication companies, and gas companies, from one county to another. Under current law, I wanted to point out that they have a certain amount of ability to share information now. If this is just extending that ability to deal with the fact that they're not allowed to share information that deals with companies that have, let's have locations in multiple counties, and this can create some problems when the tax forms that are submitted to the department to the assessors perhaps have property that's deleted or changed from one location to another, and it can be confusing if the departments or the agencies can't share that information. An amendment, a dash one amendment, is available to you that was presented when we met last, and that amendment will allow certain companies, not all, but certain companies described in ORS 308.805, which are mutual cooperative electric companies that are nonprofits. Those companies have been granted under the dash one the ability to move their filing date forward from January 1 to March 1.
Thank you. As I recall, we acted on that amendment on a different bill, didn't we?
Mm-hmm. And it's the same amendment.
Right,
it's
so
also
we probably don't need it on this bill. Why don't you review that? My recollection is that it brings in a different section of the statute than the statute that's considered on SB 171. And so it would be cumulative to adopt it twice.
Okay. Okay.
Would you check on that and see what you think?
Yes, I will.
And we have a public hearing open on Senate Bill 171. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on that Senate bill? With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 171. Colleagues, are you ready to work the bill? All right. With that, we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 171. Colleagues, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move Senate Bill 171 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 171 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative
Brown. Aye. Excused.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Aye. The Senate Bill 171, having received the required majority, is sent to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. What's your pleasure on this one? I note there was one no in the Senate.
Can I, as an aside, and Representative Gelser will appreciate this. I won't divulge a source. I wouldn't put that much pressure on the source, but it's come to my attention, and I'll throw it out there for the committee to consider, that you're never going to find a Senate vote that's unanimous this session, because there's some sort of bet going on about who can accumulate the most no votes. I don't lay that at any particular individual's feet, nor can I prove this theory, but it's a theory that's been tested, and so I'd submit that as we consider some of these bills that have one or two Senate no votes that seem sort of like they should be slam dunks.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if that's a motion for the consent.
Well, it sounds
it's
like
just, it's just for consideration, Mr. Chair.
That's
as we move forward.
Mr. Chair, let me put on the record, too, while we're discussing this, the reason that I am always squirming when you ask for consent is these are revenue bills, and revenue bills cause a lot of people's eyebrows to go up, and they notice, and they may seem routine and nothing to us, but I always feel like we owe our colleagues something that allows them to at least ask questions because they come out of this committee, and that's why I'm always sort of going when you say consent calendar.
Thank you. All right. Well, that being the case, I will carry this bill. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 171. I think I learned more than I wanted to know.
Yeah.
Are we ready for the public hearing on Senate Bill 211?
Yeah.
I guess we are. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 211.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 211 deals with a high-cost disability grant. You'll recall from orientation, hopefully, that the school equalization formula has four different grants in it. This is one of those. The grant is for a cost exceeding $30,000 per student for the high-cost disability students. And currently there is a $12 million statewide total limit on what those grants can be through the formula. The bill proposes raising that $12 million to $18 million per year, and that would become effective with the 07-08 school year. You have some information that gives you an idea by school district of the amount of the grant under the current law with the $12 million limit. The data for the Senate Bill 211 column is based on 05-06 data. That was the most recent available. And then you can see what the overall impact is for the combination of the four grants or the formula revenue amount and what that is per student. So basically it would allow $6 million more dollars going from the 12 to the 18 million to be distributed as high-cost disability grants. That $6 million would come out of the general purpose grant. Currently, it's that 0506 number is $15.3 million. That will increase, but it could still be under the $18 million for a year or two. if it does stay under the $18 million, any amount between the grant and $18 million would still be distributed as a general purpose grant.
Thank you. We have three people to testify on this bill, Nancy, Chuck, and Brian. And I do it that way because I can only read some of the last names. I will note while they're getting seated that this concept is the first concept that I lobbied the legislature on when I was a new member of the school board in Eugene in 1995. Please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Normally, we would be represented on this bill by Kent Hunsaker, our executive director, who serves on the Fiscal and Accountability Advisory Group, which deals with this issue with the Department of Education. But Mr. Hunsaker is out of town at a conference. He asked me to express COSA's strong support for the bill. This will raise the support for high-cost disability, low-incidence students from about 65% to about 100% by raising it from $12 to $18 million. This, I think, Mr. Chairman, probably the best description of this particular program is as an insurance policy for all school districts where high-cost, these low-incidence, high-cost disability students will arrive tends to be at times somewhat random, although you will find them primarily in districts where there are available health care services. These are students with substantial needs and are very high cost. Again, this will take the current coverage from 65 to 100%. Ms. Chairman, I wouldn't be surprised if we'll be back within the next several years again asking for this to be raised. These are costs that are going up considerably and rapidly. Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Latini. I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships for the department. I think everything about the bill was already said very clearly. The only thing I might add to it is that we do have a committee in special education called the Finance and Accountability Committee, which is made up of school districts, ESDs, parents, advocates, higher ed, COSA, and OSBA. And at first year of this bill, when we looked at the data, one of the things that they did recommend, and we did do, as you noticed, is that initially it was recommended that the eligible districts apply for it these funds if it costs $20,000 a year or more. And as we looked at the data and to really try to target it to the most needy students, the committee recommended, and it did occur, that we raised it to $30,000 per year per student. And those are the eligible students that districts can apply for these funds. And we feel that it's far more targeted to the most needy students in Oregon. Anything else I would say would be repeating what has been well said already.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Brian Reeder, Department of Education. Just want to sort of reinforce what Mr. Bennett said. He described it as an insurance policy, and I think that's probably the best way to look at this program. Some of these students cost in excess of $100,000 to serve, and that can be absolutely devastating to the budget of a medium or small size school district. So this is really a way to get the dollars where they need to be, and I think this is probably the most efficient way to do that in the context of in the case of special education services. So just wanted to strongly support on the part of the department this approach to getting the dollars where they need to be.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. This is my third time through with this.
Yes.
And I'm always struck by the impacts that it can have on a small
district that, and reassure me again that in some ways these numbers that Steve gives us are sort of like represent a single student. One student in some of these small districts can make the difference, enormous difference in so would you kind of go over that just to remind us that, because at the end it's sort of an uneven distribution pattern. You understand what I'm saying, Brian? That one student moving from one district to another can have a huge impact on a small district with regard to this grant. And $130,000, $40,000, $50,000, $75,000 student moving into a small district makes a big difference.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, that's exactly right. Just, you know, as an example, we have a fair number of small school districts in Oregon, and a school district with, say, 50 students in it may have a general fund budget on the order of $500,000, $600,000. And a single student moving in that costs $100,000 to serve takes a big bite out of that $500,000 budget. So, it truly can make the difference between... It could drive class sizes up. It could potentially result in the necessity to lay off teachers. I mean, it could be that dramatic in a small district.
Thank you. Other questions, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify, too, who these students are. These aren't always necessarily students that we think of as students with disabilities who are using wheelchairs or who are physically disabled. This may also include, am I correct, students with very high behavioral needs that may be even in out-of-state, out-of-district placements where the district becomes responsible for paying that tuition?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Gelser, you're absolutely right. It isn't just the severely disabled in the track that normal people think about. It's any child with a high need that could exceed. And sometimes kids you just described in wheelchairs don't cost as much as some of those behavioral issues.
Thanks. And just as a follow-up, as I was looking at these, I was looking at the school district that I was on the board of for a while and looked at the amount of the high-cost grant, and it's dropped some. We did have a student in that district that was an excess of $100,000 a year. It was not a student with a physical or developmental disability. It was a mental health issue. But I can think of many children that many of us would think of as very profoundly disabled that I think most people, when they look at them, think, boy, that's a really costly student to serve in school, and I just want to be careful that we don't give the impression that every child with complex medical needs is costing their school districts in excess of $30,000, because they don't.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, a spinoff of what Representative Gelser, what you're sharing with, I'm curious, and I just want to kind of get this clear. So, if we have a student that's out does not live in this state, we're paying for that to some degree, but there's a connection here? I don't understand that.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Olson, if the school district chooses to place the child in an out-of-state placement, the school district would be responsible for serving and paying for that student. And that may happen if there are no places available and no beds available in the state, and they have searched that out already.
Okay. Follow up.
Yes, please.
Okay, well, Mr. Reed, this might be more in line with you, and follow up then, and it's kind of a dual question. How many? You mentioned that there are some students that are up in the neighborhood of about $100,000. How many of those do you have any idea we have in the state like that, and how many do we have what Nancy just described that are outside of state?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Olson, I off the top of my head, I don't know how many students we have in the roughly $100,000 range.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Olson, we probably have fewer in the group that I was just talking about because of this high-cost disability. Districts have more options as opposed to and being able to say we can bring a child back, and we can push for that. There was a... before I came to the department, there was some kind of a reimbursement package for districts who had to place out of state. And so it seemed like we would almost be encouraged to place out of state because you got reimbursement. We don't have that anymore, and I think it's much better for us.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to go through the school finance distribution page that you've distributed. And so, just to make certain that we all understand it, I'm looking at the columns. Obviously, the first one is the name of the school district. And then you've got a heading called High Cost Disability Grant. The first column there, it appears to be the current law. That is, the for the amounts above $30,000, districts would be reimbursed up to a total amount for the entire state of $12 million.
Correct.
Then the next column, which is the third column here, would be the same formulation based on a total expenditure of $18 million for the state. So those two columns I understand without much difficulty. The next four columns all are based on the estimated formula for next year. The first column is the current law. The second column would be the law applying the bill, which would have the effect of reducing the funds available by $6 million overall.
Mr. Chair, you'll note that the state totals are the same.
State totals are the same.
Right.
Maybe I do misunderstand it then.
What it's showing is how that shift from $12 million to $15.3 million in the high-cost disability grant affects the total formula dollars.
And it's based on 15.3, not 18.
Correct.
Because that's how much we expect to be utilized.
Mr. Chair, the $15.3 million is the latest number that we have for 05-06. That will increase to something probably near $18 million in 07-08.
Now we're getting to the column that I'm, two columns I'm concerned about. The next column is the difference. And that appears to be the difference between the current law and SB 211A
right.
column. And then the last one is the ADMW difference, that difference divided by ADMW.
Correct.
What I don't understand is why some school districts appear to have a larger amount under SB 211A than when I would expect that in all cases the districts would actually have a smaller amount, not counting, of course, their high-cost disability grant. How does that happen?
Mr. Chair, that difference column is driven by what is happening that between the high-cost disability grant and the general purpose grant. There are some districts that will benefit, that have high-cost disabilities, will benefit from the increase in the grant, but at the same time they're losing on the general purpose grant either as much or more than what they gain from any increase in the high-cost disability grant.
I find it curious, though, that there are some districts that appear to gain even on the SB 211 formulation. Does that include then the SB 211 high cost disability grant?
Yes, it does. The formula dollars are for all four grants in the formula.
All right.
Except for the facility grant dollars are not in there.
I probably could have figured that out for myself, but this is helpful. Representative Berger.
Well, this goes back to my original comment when I asked the question. This, Steve, then is driven by the fact that if you have a student population in a district that is heavily impacted here, they could through this grant, a small school population but a high impact population, you could have a big swing here in terms of dollars going to a single district relative the ADMW, the difference per ADMW because of specific students in specific districts. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes, I think you are.
That's what I was driving at when I asked the question. It is an uneven based on the where these particular types of students, there aren't that many, but they're huge impact.
There's about 1,300 of them.
Yes. Yeah. So if they're in a certain district, it could have a huge impact on a district.
And if I could just add to that, it seems to me that it, to some extent, it's the luck of the draw.
Right.
This printout may deal with the history, but it may not reflect next year at all because the students may be in different places. And so it's useful to notice that. And I do note that some of the districts that are most significantly affected by this change are some relatively small school districts. Coquille, for example. down in Coos County. And Brookings Harbor in Curry County would benefit from the grant. Overall, most districts are going to lose a little bit, aren't they? But when lightning strikes and you get one of these students, you don't have to bust the budget to pay for it.
Mr. Chair, there's about, there's 74 districts that are shown here as having increased high-cost disability grants. Of those 74, only 33 are net gainers.
Thank you. And we would expect that to be true routinely, wouldn't we? But it might be a different 33.
Correct.
All right. Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on Senate Bill 211? Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 211. Colleagues, we don't have a work session scheduled on that bill today. We'll bring that up later, I suspect. And with that, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3364. Oh, you're back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3364 expands the reforestation credit against personal income and corporate excise and income taxes to include in the base costs certain fees established by the state forester. For some context here, the reforestation credit was created in 1979, and the goal of it is to reforest underproductive commercial forest land. And that the cost or the credit is 50% of certain qualified costs, and those qualified costs include site preparation, tree planting, and silviculture treatments, such as moisture erosion and animal damage control. And the credit is taken 25%, or half of the 50% is taken in the first year, and then the other half is taken a couple years later after the growth has been established. One thing I need to point out about the fee that's referenced in the bill, I believe the IRS reference there on line 9 of the bill is the incorrect fee that's referenced.
Uh-oh.
The 529 or 526.4905C is a fee pertaining to the afforestation of idle lands. So that is a fee that has been around since about 1995. In the 2005 session, there was a fee created with respect to the reforestation credit just last session, and that is the site for that is it's 315106, and I believe forestry is here and they're going to comment on that, so that's a potential amendment to the bill.
Okay, thank you. Very good. Well, we have three people interested in this bill today: Peter Doherty, Christina McNitt, and Ray Wilkerson. I suspect that they will answer some of those questions. Mr. Doherty, we've received your letter. Why don't you go ahead? You want to go the other way? That's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt with the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. And, Chris, you are on the ball. I'm not exactly sure how much more I can add to that, but thank you for catching my goof. And I'll talk a little bit more about this bill. But House Bill 3364 would specifically allow the administrative fees that are charged to administer this program in the Department of Forestry, the Reforestation Tax Credit Program, which was explained to you. Last session, the funding for the administration of that program was basically disappearing through a number of tax changes in the forestry world. And so there was a discussion about how to continue this valuable program. And out of that, the landowners agreed to go ahead and pay a fee for service. And part of that agreement in the Ways and Means process, it was through a budget note and a budget allocation, was that the actual fee for service would also be an eligible cost for the program. And somehow in the magic of Ways and Means, that kind of got washed out in the end. We didn't even realize it until a couple months later. So basically this tax credit program, which was initially established in 1979, is a credit against income taxes equal to 50% of the reforestation costs for underproductive forest lands, and it's used in two instances. That's when to fully stock land that otherwise doesn't have a manageable timber stand where the Forest Practice Act wouldn't otherwise require it to be so. And in the second and very important case is to restock a forest destroyed by wildfire. It was my drafting error, I think, with legislative counsel. You'll see on page one of the very simple bill, line nine, it refers to ORS 526-495 sub C, which is the afforestation program, not the reforestation program. So I goofed, and I have need to have amendments made so that site is changed to 315-106 sub 4. And with that all, Peter, I think you're next.
Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Doherty. I'm the private forest programmer for the private forest program director for the department. I'm pleased to have this opportunity to testify in support of this House bill, which does make a small change to the underproductive forest land conversion tax credit program. And as Chris noted, the goal of this tax credit program is to encourage conversion of bare land, brush field, and otherwise underproductive forest land into well-stocked forest. And as Christina noted, it includes forest lands that are lost to wildfire, given that they don't have any merchantable timber to salvage, so that there is no product that could help cover the reforestation cost. The best way to think of this credit is it represents an investment in forest land which will yield future timber harvest and future tax revenues. And as Christina noted, in the original conception of this bill, the department supported having the administrative cost included in as eligible cost, and that was included in the original bill throughout the public hearings, but was removed just before it was passed. So this change would allow that application fee, or essentially one half of it, be counted as a tax credit. And while this change seems small, the current fee is only $300, it is a big disincentive to small landowners. So for instance, woodland owner that wanted to reforest a 5-acre parcel could have that application fee exceed the initial preliminary tax credit that they would get. So it ends up discouraging some of our small woodland owners from participating in this program. And we actually saw a 44% drop in participation from 2005-2006. And finally, as Christina noted, there is that need for a minor amendment. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council, just here briefly to lend support for this bill also, and also for this program. It's not limited to small landowners. It's limited to anybody that owns land that's capable of producing good forests but is currently not. And the conversion process to turn that into a productive forest is very expensive, and that's the reason why this tax credit program exists. Just one more piece of background on this. Prior to last session, the administrative costs of this program were paid through the Western Oregon Severance Tax, and that tax has been abolished by the legislature, and that was the reason why a new administrative mechanism was needed to cover the administrative costs, and this fee was established for the applicants to pay. And as both of the previous witnesses have testified, I can attest to also that this administrative cost was intended last session to be part of the eligible for the tax credit itself, and something happened in the Ways and Means Committee and it didn't work. But so that's the reason this bill is back this year to fix that error. So thank you for your attention.
Okay. I'm assuming that you went through an extensive hearing in the Agriculture Committee to talk about the details of the way this system works. But I think it might be beneficial for us to have at least a brief overview of the costs that are involved in this process, and how this fits in with that cost. This is an area that I'm not familiar with, at least, and I suspect other members of the committee aren't either.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm not how detailed of a description you want, but I'll give you some overview. The tax credit limit is $3.5 million per year, although we've never exceeded $350,000 of expenditures in terms of tax credit for any year. The way it works is, and I would say, and on average, we're spending in terms of per acre, something around $300 is an upper limit on the credit they're getting per acre on average in this program. Since 1987, we've done 55,000 acres have been successfully reforested. As explained by Chris, the fee works that they're given one quarter of the initial cost incurred in the first year of planting. So they're getting reimbursed for one half of the reforestation cost. And then the remaining part of the credit, the one quarter of the first year cost plus half of any additional maintenance cost, is only granted once the forest stand is certified to be free to grow. It is actually successfully established. I think that really gives the highlights of the program. If you have specific other questions, I would be glad to follow up.
Mr. Chair, can I add to that?
Yes, please.
Maybe, Christina McNitt, for the record, maybe just sort of a philosophical overview of why the program even exists. And I think there was a recognition that the state actually, there's a lot of underproductive but potentially highly productive forest land in Oregon. But to get it to that state, it usually costs at least twice as much to do the site prep and remove the blackberries, remove the scrub, do what you need to do to get a state of timber free to grow. So from a public policy standpoint, I think that's why this tax credit program has been successful over the years as a public policy, because it encourages that reforestation of otherwise scrubland and helps the landowner get to that point, recognizing it's quite an investment to do so.
Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, I'll make one other point, is that I stated that this was an investment in forest land, and if you'll be interested in a simple example, if you had 100 acres and spent $300 in tax credit, the state would have incurred a cost of $30,000 to reforest this 100 acres. Essentially, 40 years from now, that acre conservatively would produce 30,000 board feet of timber. At reasonable cost, that would generate $72,000 in direct income tax 40 years from now. It would also generate 48 jobs and an additional $144,000 in income tax revenue in year 40. And so in a sense, what we're investing in is getting something reforested to generate future income and future income tax.
Thank you very much. A minute ago you also talked about the Forest Practices Act. The Forest Practices Act, as I understand it, requires reforestation after the time of harvest. This tax does not apply, does it, this credit does not apply to those situations where the Forest Practices Act requires replanting.
Chair Barnhart, member of committees, in fact, it specifically excludes applying this tax to any of those cases.
Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? Yes. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is kind of an indication of how important it is to reforest these scrublands. I would be interested in the panel reminding me how many acres it is that we lose of forest land to alternative uses each year in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, a number from the Oregon Small Woodlands Association perspective from Oregon State, we are looking at a conversion rate of 26,000 acres a year from non-industrial forest land ownership patterns to other uses.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And someone else, Representative Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Specific to this legislation, this is a correction from, it was last session when a fee was allowed on this, and it was a mistake that the fee did not get included. How much are those fees?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Berger, the fee is currently $300 per applicant. On average, over the past 5 years, we've had about 36 applications per year.
Thank you.
We have roughly calculated on the back of an envelope that this bill would incur a fee of about $5,000 a year.
Thank you. This is a fairly small item. We're looking here to see if there's a sunset on this tax credit.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've had occasion to be a student of your committee for the last week. I anticipated that. And so I spoke with the department and with my colleague here, and we kind of puzzled that around because in my experience, my vast experience of 1 week in this committee, it seems that you've asked proponents of a bill, you know, what would fit their situation. And because we have this situation where we're growing these baby trees and they need to be cared for and managed until they're at a free-to-grow state, we were looking at something longer term, like maybe 15 years would be an appropriate sunset.
Okay. And there is no sunset on the current credit.
Chair.
That this would be a small expansion of.
Chair and members of the committee, that is correct. There is currently no sunset on this program.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add something, though, there is a cap in statute, a maximum expenditure, tax expenditure, if you will, from this program. And it's never, as Mr. Doherty indicated, it had never been exceeded, but that is one way of limiting the impact of this program on the budget.
Certainly is. Certainly would be. The other thing that we were doing with all of these tax credit bills is making certain that we have some statement of the purpose of the credit, and I think that it's contained in your testimony, but if we could have that boiled down to a shorter statement. And then a sense of how the department would go about measuring that. I suspect the department is asked by the Department of Revenue each biennium when they prepare the tax expenditure report to comment on the tax credit. And it would be useful for the committee to see before we, as we're looking at the amendments, what the measurements are that the department would use in responding to the Department of Revenue's request for information about the effectiveness of the tax credit at that time.
Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, the goal, as I briefly stated, is to convert underproductive forest land into fully stocked forest stands. And the direct measure of accomplishment would be acres certified as free to grow, fully stocked forest stands. And in fact, the final tax credit is not issued until the state forester certifies so many acres as being free to grow, fully stocked stands. So there's a clearly built-in accountability measure in the current practices of administering the program.
Thank you. That makes it very simple, doesn't it? So your task then to get to the administrator is simply a written statement of those two things, and it sounds as though we'll be ready to work on this one when the amendments are ready. Thank you. Is there anything else for this panel? Yes, Representative Olson.
And actually, Peter, for you probably, since you kind of gave us a little overview and everything, is there a specific age that you go in to do this, that you're targeting?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Olson, a specific age of the existing stand?
Exactly.
Not specifically, and generally, these stands would have very few or no trees, so it would be a brush field, and we can't usually specify an age for those, but it could also be applied to a stand from past practices prior to the Forest Practices Act that had very few trees, but generally it's brush fields and, in the other case, burned forest.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony, and good luck on the reforestation. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3364? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3364. And if I can find my calendar, we're down to the work session on House Bill 3468. And we'll open the work session on House Bill 3468.
Mr. Chair?
Mary.
Thank you. House Bill 3468 creates a privilege tax of two cents per thousand board feet of merchantable forest product for the purpose of administering the Oregon Smoke Management Plan in an amount not to exceed 40% of the total expenditures approved by the Legislative Assembly for this purpose. Applies the forest products harvest tax reporting periods beginning January 1, 2008, and in addition, but not in lieu of other appropriations, there is appropriated to the State Forestry Department for the purpose of forest smoke management a $240,000 amount for the biennium beginning July 1, 2007. Takes effect 91 days after signed die. There is a subsequent referral to this, to Ways and Means, and the revenue impact on this that was estimated, the signs are wrong, I apologize, that needs to be a positive amount in each box.
Oh, these are plus, yes.
These are pluses,
of course,
yes.
Yeah.
But in the text, you'll note that the Department of Forestry estimated the dollar amount based on the estimates of the forest harvest and estimates about $86,000 per year.
From a revenue standpoint, is this bill is ready to go, isn't it?
Yes,
I mean, the administration issues are worked out. All right. Committee, this bill goes to Ways and Means.
Don't have my file here. Do you have a copy of the bill?
Yeah. The revenue impact statement, you see it?
Yeah.
The signs are wrong, she said, but otherwise it accurately reflects the magnitude of the tax. Colleagues, we had a public hearing last week, I think. Are we ready? Is there a motion on this bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move House Bill 3468 to the Ways and Means New Pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves House Bill 3468 to the floor with a New Pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion? Call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Excused.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion having received the required majority, the bill goes to goes to Ways and Means, and with that we'll close the work session on House Bill 3468. And with that, committee, for the first time in some time, we actually have exhausted our agenda, and the committee is adjourned.